start out this morning with what might sound like the announcements part two, but a couple of things that we didn't get to Ross. First of all, you might be interested in knowing, as it's been suggested in the bulletin, that we are in the last 3 weeks of our cable broadcasting television program. The elders had decided some short time ago that after a lengthy period of broadcasting, particularly Robert Harkrider's series, which have been good ones, that will be discontinued in about 3 weeks' time, which is the amount of notice that we had to give the station, particularly because of just the lack of response from listeners, and it was felt maybe that those funds could be used better elsewhere. However, for the next 3 weeks, as was the case last Sunday, we will be airing some programs produced by some of the members here. Several months back, the possibility was contemplated of producing our own program. We did a couple of programs starting out in the Gospel of Luke, and although it was decided, I think wisely so, not to continue those because of the expense and time involved, we are yet airing the second one of those this afternoon at 1:30. And so if you're interested in watching those, you might want to tune in if you have not done so recently, and you'll see a different program. And that will be the case for the next couple of weeks. So that's aired this afternoon at 1:30. You can check the stations back on the TV schedule posted on the bulletin board, and then I think again Wednesday morning at 11:30 if you're interested in watching those particular programs. The second thing I want to also mention is that this afternoon David Tant had asked us to announce that this afternoon at the Roswell congregation he will be speaking at their 4 o'clock service, which is when they normally conduct that service, on what the Bible has to say about the subject of sex. And then following that service, Brother Mike Fain, who has been visiting in the area the last couple of weeks, staying in the home of Mary and Marty Broadwell, will be there speaking to those, particularly the young people. And David wanted to invite any here that were interested in going and being a part of that. Mike spoke to our young people a couple of weeks ago on a Wednesday evening, and I think the things that he has to say would be valuable for any who are interested in going. And I might just note that if you're interested in being busy this afternoon, if you're in Group 1, you can attend the group meeting, go to the College Park service, go up to Roswell and be back this evening for the service if you want to keep busy. We'll certainly not keep you from doing that. When we were in England, one of the habits that I took up that I suppose is particularly British is to read the newspaper. Now, we have newspapers here, but if you go over to England or wherever, you'll find that there are on any given day probably 10 or 12 titles of newspapers on sale. Particularly that's true with the Sunday newspaper. And I got in the habit of buying the Sunday Times, and one of the inserts on Sunday is a Sunday Times magazine similar to what we would have here. And one of the articles on the very back page of that each week was an article entitled "A Life in the Day of," and then it would be the particular person that they had interviewed. That sounds almost like they got mixed up. It's supposed to be a day in the life of. But that was really a play on that terminology, in order to suggest that really by looking at the routine of a person on any given day, and they would take some famous person or maybe some lesser known person in which people would have an interest, and they would just have that person describe what they do on any given day, a sort of a routine they go through. But the idea really was that by viewing what that person does, we get an insight into really what their priorities are in life, what's important to them, what kind of outlook they have on life. And so from time to time, there would be interest in reading maybe some particular person about whom we might know something. What if someone were to do that with our lives? What if they were to interview us about our regular routine during a day? What would they find out? Suppose yesterday you were to describe the routine through which you went. What would they be able to find out about your life? Now, you might reply by saying immediately, well, yesterday's not a very good test. You know, I was running around all day, and we had a bunch of things to do that we don't normally do, and that really wouldn't tell what my priorities are. Really, Sunday would be a better day that would describe particularly my spiritual priorities. And I'm sure that's true. And maybe there is some latitude there in determining just what we're about taking any particular given day. And yet, on the other hand, I think what we do during the course of a day, over and over again, does say something about who we are. And I think that's particularly true about Jesus. When we look in the New Testament, we get a lot of information about what Jesus did during his lifetime here upon the earth, particularly the 3-plus years of his ministry. But there are even occasions when the gospel writers give us an insight maybe into a particular 24-hour period that Jesus spent. One of those that we have, which I would like to examine with you this morning, is one found in John chapter 4. And you probably will immediately recognize this particular section of Scripture as Jesus and his discussion with the woman at the well. And yet I would like to suggest that from this passage we can learn much about Jesus' life, a life in the day of Jesus. I want to look at the events that transpire here in these brief amount of verses and see if we can't learn something together about what was important to Jesus. I think as we begin looking at the passage, and we don't have time to read it in full, but one of the things that strikes us right away is the situation, the circumstance, which finds Jesus going with some of his disciples, leaving Judea where apparently he's been for some period of time, already beginning his ministry, and now traveling north up to the province of Galilee from which he had come. But on his way to Galilee, he has to pass through Samaria. I don't have a map here. But Palestine in that time could be sectioned off into the northern province of Galilee, the middle province of Samaria, and the southern province of Judea. And that is significant because for Jews to go from Judea back home to Galilee, they had to go through Samaria. Samaria was a place where the Samaritans lived. But that's significant because these Samaritans were considered a sort of half-breed of Jew. Whether that's literally true or not is up to some question. But apparently, when back in the Old Testament, the northern 10 tribes of Israel were taken away into captivity, the practice of the Assyrian government was to transplant those people with some of their Assyrians back in that area. And so there could have possibly developed this interchange between the Samaritans, the people in that area, and the Assyrians, a sort of a half-breed or half-race of Jew. Whether that was literally true or not, there was a great deal of enmity, distaste, the Jew for the Samaritan. We are confronted daily with prejudices that exist around the globe. And yet, this one would stand out as much as any that we would see today, as far as a sort of a hatred, an enmity, a contempt that each of these groups held for the other. And so I think it's simply significant that Jesus is traveling through this area. He's going through an area that the Jews would avoid if they were traveling north to south. They would cross over the Jordan to the other side in order to come into Judea just to avoid the Samaritan people. But as Jesus makes this journey, I want you to notice, to begin with, that we find on this particular occasion, on this day, a revelation, really, of Jesus' humanity. Jesus, if you can picture this, is traveling with his disciples. I don't know how long the journey was that day. The distance from Jerusalem to this place at Mount Gerizim might have been about 20 miles. Maybe they had only traveled part of that journey this day. But as they're making that long, hot, dusty journey down that road, they come to this spot at Jacob's Well, a place of great historical significance, and they pause in their journey. It was about the middle of the day. And I want you to notice that concerning Jesus, it says in verse 6, "Now Jacob's well was there. Jesus, therefore, being wearied from his journey, sat thus by the well." Jesus was tired. Have you ever been through a day where you worked hard physically, or maybe it was just mental exhaustion from the duties at work? And you get home at night, maybe there have been other things going on, and you just kind of get to your bed and you're ready to collapse in the bed. Bone tired, totally exhausted, physically and emotionally drained. Jesus understands that. because he was wearied and fatigued from his travel on this occasion. Jesus was weary. Not only so, but he was thirsty. He asked in verse 7, this Samaritan woman who comes to the well for a drink. And more than that, he sends his disciples into the city for food. Jesus got hungry. And we read on other occasions about these same kinds of things that he experienced as a human being. We read, for instance, about him fasting for 40 days and then being tempted by Satan in the wilderness, which makes only sense if Jesus experiences the same feelings that we do. We read about one occasion where he travels across the Sea of Galilee in a boat and apparently from physical exhaustion falls asleep during a raging storm from which his disciples have to wake him. Now, all of that suggests that Jesus, even though he was God, was also man. He experienced what we experience in a physical way. And that makes so much more meaningful a passage such as that we find in Hebrews chapter 4, when the writer there attempting to encourage us to bring our needs before God at his throne says this of Jesus, verse 15. He says, "For we do not have a high priest who cannot sympathize with our weaknesses, but was in all points tempted as we are, yet without sin." That statement means absolutely nothing if Jesus is some superman on earth and he doesn't experience what we do. But knowing on this occasion that he was tired, he was exhausted, he was thirsty, he was hungry, helps us understand that Jesus knows our needs in a most intimate way. But I want to suggest, secondly, that we find something else that's revealed in John chapter 4. This particular occasion reveals the antidote of Jesus for human injustice. Now, why do I say that? Notice that as the discussion ensues, we find out something about the state of a person in that culture at that time. Jesus, first of all, speaks to this woman, verse 9, asking in verse 7 to give me a drink, and the woman responds this way, "How is it that you, being a Jew, ask a drink from me, a Samaritan woman?" Now that illustrates what I said earlier. There was a contempt between the Jew and the Samaritan. You recall in Luke's account, on one occasion, Jesus and his disciples going through Samaria south to Judea, and the Samaritans refusing their hospitality, and some of the apostles saying, "Well, let's bring fire down on those people right away. Let's take care of these people." That's the kind of feeling that existed between them. And on this occasion, notice also that when the disciples finally come back later and return to Jesus, having gotten food in the town, it says in verse 27 that no one asked him about his discussion with her, but they marveled that he had talked with a woman. Now, without any more commentary, that suggests something about the place of a woman in that day and time. I know that there are those who today feel like the woman is ill-treated. Certainly the feminist movement has much to say about the woman being unequal with the man. And there might be some validity to some of the practices that are carried on that would warrant that kind of a conclusion. But let me suggest that back in Bible times, it seems that the woman's place was much lower still. Here illustrated by the fact that apparently it was not even common practice for a man to speak with a woman, at least in public. And here was a woman coming to the well to draw water. Now let me raise the question, what did Jesus do? Jesus, Creator, knowing that he had been there with the Father when both man and woman were created, knows that this is not the woman's place, that this is an unjust practice, that this would be so, that this enmity between Jew and Samaritan should not exist. What does Jesus do? Well, if there was such a person today, I would suggest that they would probably start some kind of a political movement. They would start some kind of a judicial process seeking to right the wrongs that exist, maybe seeking legally to break down the barriers between Jew and Samaritan. or seeking somehow to elevate the status of this woman at the well so that she didn't have to go out and draw the water, or that she wasn't treated in an unkind fashion. Now, why didn't Jesus do that? There's no indication here that he does. He doesn't speak to that end. There's no indication that he got his disciples to do that kind of thing. There's no indication that after he ascended to heaven that the apostles and others start some kind of a political movement to solve the problems of injustice that exist in society. Indeed, Jesus could have done that. He had the political clout to do it. In John 6 and verse 14, after feeding the 5,000, it said the multitude wanted to make him a king. Why, he could have started the Palestine movement there, the Palestine organization, and got some clout there in Jerusalem and caused some real problems for the leaders who were afraid of him anyway. But that's not what Jesus is about. How does he counter the injustice that he finds? I would suggest to you that really what he does is he shows kindness to this woman. He speaks to her. And then he evidences a concern for her situation. Now that may seem like a feeble attempt to take care of some kind of injustice. And yet that's what Jesus does. And I would suggest to you that often, maybe that's the most that we can accomplish. Now, I'm not suggesting that as a part of this great country, we don't have a voice politically and a vote, and we can do something and say something about what's going on. But that pales to me in comparison by the influence that each of us have in our lives on a day-to-day basis. If there's prejudice, what can we do about that prejudice? We can overcome it ourselves and show that we're not going to be party to it. If there's harassment of some kind, we are not going to get back at someone seeking vindication. We're going to let God be the judge. And that's difficult to do. But as Jesus suggests in Matthew 25, when he pictures the judgment, the separation between sheep and goats, he suggests there that those who are acceptable, the sheep, are those who have shown kindness on a personal basis. And they say, Lord, when did we do this to you? And he said, inasmuch as you gave a cup of cold water or fed someone who was hungry or clothed someone who was naked or visited someone who was sick, you were doing it to me. That's the solution to the problem of injustice. Now, it doesn't solve it in the sense that it no longer exists. But I think as Christians, each of us have an individual responsibility to do what we can in our setting to overcome what problems may exist. I think one of the problems that our society has as it becomes increasingly godless is that there exists a moral vacuum which is the basis upon which people should be acting. And when they don't act like they should, people know that that's not right. And they immediately begin seeking some kind of litigation about someone else to equal the balances. And if something's done that's wrong, why, somebody wants to get back at somebody else. And there develops a legalism which far surpasses anything that the Old or New Testament describes. You've got a set of regulations and laws that are supposed to keep people in check, and they don't work anyway most of the time. And all that to try and cope with man's injustice to man. That's never going to completely solve the problem. The antidote that Jesus gives is acting in a Christ-like fashion. And that's what this particular example reveals to us. Well, let's notice further that Jesus evidences on this occasion a willingness to, I think, rebuke evil on the part of this woman. As he begins to talk to her and offer to her a spiritual water which would cause her never to thirst, notice that he tells her in verse 16, go and call your husband and come here. And the woman replies by saying, verse 17, I have no husband. And Jesus, knowing her, says, you have well said, I have no husband, for you have had five husbands, and the one whom you now have is not your husband. In that you spoke truly. Now, I don't know more about the woman's background than is stated here. I don't know what those previous five husbands, what those relationships had been. But Jesus says specifically, you have someone right now, apparently a relationship, and that person is not yours. You have no right to them. And Jesus points that out to the woman. Now, he continues his discussion, but he does not refrain from pointing out and calling to her attention that her situation is not a right one. I think we are, again, increasingly finding ourselves in situations like that today. For those my age and older, I think our heads begin to spin when we just look at the moral climate that exists today. We think about people living together in a relationship that the Bible terms fornication. That is common practice. That is accepted. For us to object to something like that or even to raise an eyebrow is seen by many to be extremist. There are moral issues all around us, questions that are being raised to which no one without a Bible basis has really a consistent answer. And yet we exist in those situations as Christians. What is our responsibility? Well, without going into great detail, let's just look at one passage, Ephesians chapter 5. And Paul points out there that a Christian cannot be involved in situations like those. Look at verse 3, for instance. He says, fornication and all uncleanness or covetousness, let it not even be named among you, as is fitting for saints. Neither filthiness, nor foolish talking, nor coarse jesting, which are not fitting, but rather giving of thanks. So number one, I can't participate myself. But now notice number two. It goes a little further than that. He says in verse 8, you were once darkness, but now are light in the Lord. Walk as children of light. Verse 10, proving what is acceptable to the Lord. And then he says in verse 11, and have no fellowship with the unfruitful works of darkness, but rather expose them. Now I can't necessarily say in every given situation what it means for us to expose the evil works of darkness. But it suggests to us, I think, a willingness to speak out if wrong is being done, if there is moral wrong, if there is something the Bible teaching and it's not right, dishonesty, whatever form it may take. And we are in a position where we can object to that or state our view that there is a responsibility to do so. I realize tact has to be used. And it's not an easy thing to do. Paul says we're to expose those evil works. Jesus shows that willingness. I realize that we're living in a time where the whole question of marriage and divorce arises, and it's very difficult sometimes to know what to do in given situations. But perhaps the wrong thing to do is to totally ignore situations like that in the sense that we're not going to be concerned in any way, shape, or form with relationships. I remember hearing a tape of Brother Paul Earnhardt commenting on this passage in reference to that kind of question. And really making the point that when we say we're not going to say anything about a person's behavior because we're afraid that that might offend them or maybe there's something that's in question, we're really saying about the gospel that we don't have enough confidence in it to convert them regardless of what change they might have to make in their life. And I think he's probably right. Do we have the courage and conviction to state those convictions? Now, once again, we have to use tact. We have to be loving and willing to go the extra mile. And yet there's a place for standing up and rebuking evil. Well, look at a fourth point. Jesus says to this woman, in fact, she seems to sort of try and go a different direction with the discussion by saying in verse 19, I perceive that you are a prophet. And then she draws the question about where their fathers worship. Now, without great detail, basically the Samaritans thought they ought to worship in Mount Gerizim, where they were. Whereas, as she points out, the Jews worship in Jerusalem. Almost trying to sidestep Jesus and saying, okay, now really, where are we to worship? And Jesus just sets that all aside. And he says, here is the real question. Are we going to be a true worshiper? Look at verse 23. But the hour is coming, and now is, when the true worshipers will worship the Father in spirit and truth, for the Father is seeking such to worship Him. Now, what does Jesus mean when He says that? This verse is often used to show that worship involves worshiping with the right frame of mind, a sincere attitude, worshiping in spirit, and worshiping in truth, according to what the Scriptures teach. And that might well be the case here. But let me suggest a different possibility for the idea of true there, worshiping in truth. Is Jesus really saying that there is true worship that now will take place as opposed to false worship that has been taking place under the Old Testament? When the Jews worshiped, for instance, offering up their sacrifices, was that false worship as opposed to true worship? I think we would agree that it's not. God had always commanded that His people be sincere in their worship and do according as He had written. Numerous instances in the Old Testament indicate that that is so. Perhaps Jesus is here speaking about true in the sense of that which is real as opposed to that which is secondary, that which is a shadow of the real thing to come. And He's saying to this woman, yes, there was a time where a different kind of worship took place, but that was a shadow of the true worship that is one day going to take place. Well, what's the change that's brought about the true worship? I think the answer lies in the response that the woman makes when she says in verse 25, I know that Messiah is coming, who is called the Christ. When He comes, He will tell us all things. And Jesus says, I who speak to you am He. I think what Jesus is saying is all that the old law was pointing towards, whether it be sacrifice, whether it be holy days, was the coming of a time when the Messiah would come and provide true redemption, the real thing. And that's why there can be true worshipers now, because Messiah has come, He is here, and we can participate in what He's brought us. And let me suggest that true worship is more than just the worship service, important as it is. I was going to say earlier that I think I often fail to just note that we have an atmosphere here that is not always present. And that's not to boast upon us, the glory is to God. But I think with the way in which our services are conducted, the seriousness with which the public part in that service is taken, the attitude of the worshipers who participate, all of that is so conducive to building us up. We preachers often say that it's more than just three times a week, but let me tell you, those three times a week are important. And when the kinds of prayers that are prayed here are offered, and we sing in the way that we do, and reflect upon the words, and concentrate upon the Lord's Supper, all of that is a powerful motivation to us as Christians. But it extends beyond that, doesn't it? True worshipers, serving the Messiah in everything that He came to accomplish. Well, let's move on to a couple of other points that I think we learned from Jesus, and one of those is what He had really come to do. We said it wasn't to solve all the world problems in terms of social injustice, so what had He come to do? Well, I think the illustration and answer lies in His very conversation with this woman. The fact that He says to her, I want more than just water. I've got some spiritual water to give you, and you'll never be thirsty if you drink from it. If He really is the Messiah, then what He is about is coming to save people. Luke 19 and 10, the Son of Man has come to seek and to save that which was lost. Now that would have very little meaning if on occasions such as these, Jesus sees someone who is lost and He ignores her. He lets the obstacles of race or of sex stand in the way of His sharing this message with her. Would that not be inconsistent? And yet here is the Messiah's true compassion illustrated in His willingness to share this message with anyone with whom He comes in contact. Would it not also be true of us as His followers that we need to have the same mindset, a willingness to share the gospel with anyone who's lost, regardless of where they might be coming from, what their condition is, what their circumstance may be. That's part of what we're about. It's not just something that we have to do, it's something that we want to participate in. And so as we share in the work of our Savior, then we are also about trying to save souls. Well, finally, how do we get to that point? What kind of motivation does Jesus have in doing this work? Now, there again, we're right back to his humanity. You say, well, Jesus was the Son of God. Why, of course he's motivated. He came from heaven. He knows what he's doing. Why, motivation is automatic. I don't know that I can work out the mind of Jesus, but I would suggest that if he struggled with the temptations, if he struggled in the garden, in the sense of having to determine to do the Father's will, then he needed to be motivated. What was his underlying motivation? Well, I think we find the answer when the disciples come back with the food and they begin their conversation with Jesus. And in fact, in verse 31, when they bring back the food, they urge him and say, Rabbi, eat. And he says, I have food to eat of which you do not know. Now put yourself in that situation. You're hungry. You've been having this discussion. They come back with the food. What would you do if they said, eat? I know what I'd do. I'd dig in right then and there. And I'd say, well, I've got this wonderful prospect over here, and just as soon as I finish my lunch, I'm going to get right back to it. That's not what Jesus said. He was hungry. But he said, I've got some kind of food that's much greater than what you brought me back. Now notice in verse 33, the disciples mistake him in what he's saying, and they ask, has anyone brought him anything to eat? And Jesus says in verse 34, my food is to do the will of him who sent me and to finish his work. What is it that drove and motivated Jesus to do all that he did? Not only to teach on an occasion like this, but ultimately to set his face to Jerusalem and to go there and to suffer and to die for our sin. His motivation was that his food was to do the will of the Father and to take part in this grand plan that he had for the salvation of men. And I think if we lack motivation at times, we need to just step back and say to ourselves, what is our motivation? Is it our goal as we rise in the morning, as we face the task of the day, as we become burdened with the cares of this world, as we find responsibilities in which we must respond and do what is right? Is it to do the will of the Father, day in and day out, on a continual, consistent basis, to love him and to share in his work, and indeed to be a part in having his work finished, bringing many sons to glory, ourselves included, perfecting our faith, being of the character that he desires, rising above all the physical, material concerns of this life, and having a spiritual preoccupation with the Father's will being done. That's what our goal should be. We need to share in Jesus, share with Jesus in what his goal was, motivating him in the activity as a part of his ministry. And so as we think about a life in the day of Jesus, we learn many lessons in what Jesus was about, what motivated him, what his purpose was, and we can learn, if we're going to be like him, what our lives should be about on a day-to-day basis. As Christians, we need to draw strength from these examples and see if we can make ourselves closer to the pattern that God has given us in his own Son. If you are not a Christian and you're here this morning, let me urge you to think about being a true worshiper. If Messiah has come, what is our responsibility? Are we going to respond to what Messiah has accomplished? He has died for us that our sins might be forgiven, but that's meaningless unless we're willing to respond and obey the will that the Father has given to us. If you're here this morning and you need to respond to the invitation by rendering obedience to the gospel or by repenting and seeking to overcome sins of which you cannot rid yourselves, We invite you to come as together we stand and sing this song of invitation.